welcome to this episode of Season 4 of The Common Bridge, where policy and current events are discussed in a fiercely nonpartisan manner. The host, Richard Helpe, is a philanthropist, entrepreneur, and political analyst who has reached over 3.5 million listeners, viewers, and readers around the world. The Common Bridge is available on the Substack website and the Substack app. Just search for The Common Bridge. You can find the program on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. The Common Bridge draws guests and audiences from across the political spectrum, and we invite you to become a free or paid subscriber on your favorite medium.
Hello and welcome to The Common Bridge. I'm your host, Rich Helpe, and very pleased and honored to be here for our 200th episode. The Common Bridge was started because the political parties were focused 100% on their partisan wars, and the former proud fourth estate of journalism had devolved into anger entertainment. And the news reporting environment is not getting any better. Ironic, in this time of such great unfettered access to original documents, more people are just digesting the narrative-driven stories and their own favorite fact-checkers. The favorite is the one who dismisses as unimportant those facts that run counter to your own political biases. And of course, if you're thinking right now, yep, that's what the other side does, you're part of the problem. Last week was a great example. I met a woman, professional with many accomplishments, and she told me this anecdote, and I will recapture it as close to her original words as I can. And she said, "I was always blasting the Rush Limbaugh listeners as fools and idiots being led. They were only getting half the story. Then I realized that on my daily long drives, I was listening exclusively to CNN and perhaps doing exactly the same thing." And then she says she started wondering, what am I not being told? Well, she's now a subscriber to The Common Bridge, and we're grateful for that, and a better news consumer too, even more importantly. So today, look at the legacy media. It's focusing on dueling January 6th narratives, the absolute necessity of drag queens in a first grader's education, and of course, the latest in the WWE scripted saga that is the latest trial by media of the heroic or despicable or heroic and despicable Donald Trump. In any way, we're all missing very important reporting of things like maybe how proxy wars might help or hurt the United States. What impact are the deficit and debt going to have on everyone? And is it a good idea to set up government agencies to function as the Ministry of Truth, especially during this time when we should be examining how the pandemic policies worked or didn't work? Oh, whoops, that got swallowed up inside the Ministry of Truth too. The goals of the Common Bridge are really simple. Bring down the noise. Demonstrate that there are good people doing good things, as many of our experts have demonstrated. A goal of the Common Bridge is to provide an alternative to bad online behavior, something where we can discuss versus sling vitriol. And most importantly, the goal of the Common Bridge is to inform rather than attempt to incite or influence people. So we're marking the 200th episode of The Common Bridge by offering a replay of an important episode, episode 131 from December 4th, 2021, where guest Matt Taibbi describes the disintegration of American journalism. And I think if you listen to this replay, you're going to see how spot on he's been. Good foundational episodes would also include Professor Daniel Crane describing how fascism is empowered by monopolies. You can find that in episode 59 from September 6th of 2020. And also Mr. Taibbi's first appearance on The Common Bridge in episode 88. That was on February 6, 2021. And he talked about one of his books that day in particular, Hate Incorporated. And he described how media outlets choose their audience and then feed them anger-provoking material that keeps them hyped up and coming back and making money for places like Fox, MSNBC, CNN, at times the New York Times, and others. You know, the predictable reporting versus the facts-based. And I think Mr. Taibbi's actual reporting is even more important now. His actual going to Loudoun County, Virginia was ignored, and people still don't understand what actually happened there. And he was invited with other journalists to investigate what was at Twitter and in communications between our government agencies and employees, and particularly executives at Twitter. He was given one directive, that is, be truthful. And he was not given any compensation. He was not given any restrictions, what he could print as long as it was truthful. There's been opposition to it. There are those who are opposed to his revealing this close communication between our government agencies and powerful social media companies who clearly want to control thought, speech, ideas, facts, and even specific people. They cannot criticize the reporting of Mr. Taibbi and others on the merits. So what do? They resort to personal attacks. I encourage you to read this because places like the Global Engagement Center, CISA, the FBI, and others, when they ask Twitter and other social media companies to throttle a message or a person, they do it. And you see this disease spreading. This morning, in a paper of record, blatant untruths were presented. They were accusing others of disinformation, not based on what was in the content, but on who was speaking. So not disputing the facts, but just saying it can't be truth because this is the person saying it. And Mr. Taibbi's own writings, which I'll quote here on the anti-speech Democratic playbook, says the style of the new anti-speech Democrat is clear. Define all government critics as lacking standing to criticize, impugn their prior opinions and associations, imply that all their beliefs are conspiracy theory, define their lack of faith in the FBI's judgment as treasonous, and declare their motivation to be financial. Lastly, when they invoke common constitutional rights, make a note that their activities exist in an uncovered carve-out of our constitutional protections. Now, this is coming from a left-leaning journalist with impeccable credentials, but he's been cast out of the circle now for doing factual reporting. Now, if you think that you're safe because you're in alignment with the censors, I think you should consider that further. That works until you utter your first word of unorthodoxy. Then you'll be cast out. Troublesome people have been eliminated from multiple platforms. Think you're safe because you aren't on that particular platform? It's easy enough to block your email, ISP, or internet carrier. You know, we might have a right to postal mail, but I don't know that we have a right to email or even a cell phone. We've seen the notion that some people and some ideas should not be allowed to express themselves. Now, of course, there are limitations, which we won't get into. But if you have had thought and you've redefined words like violence or harm to mere words, you're on that slippery slope to repressed speech. So reporting is crucial to our constitutional republic form of government. This is our tool for self-governing. It's reporting, not narratives. Keep an open mind. What are the facts versus who is saying it? There's a lot more that unites us than what divides us. And that united world is only possible with our freedoms of the First Amendment. So have a listen now to the replay of the second Common Bridge interview with Matt Taibbi. And I thank all my guests, listeners, readers, and viewers for their support of the program. We're in this really strange part of history that we have this administrative state that it has a lot of power and lots of edicts and ability to implement things that affect people's lives, although there's really not any legislative recourse to that at all. And then the media models that we've discussed many times on the show, and especially with our guest today, Matt Taibbi, that the business models of the global media and internet companies, they're really not out there in a search for truth, but they're really about picking their audience and dividing us. So that's what our topic is today on The Common Bridge, is with renowned writer Matt Taibbi about the state of the world, where the power of the Fourth Estate has been, where it is today, and maybe a little bit about where it should be headed. So Matt, welcome to The Common Bridge.
Thanks for having me.
Continue to enjoy your books. The Great Divide was very, very good. We listened to it on a long drive. Your columns have been going great. Substack is, wow, what you've done with that. And is that the new media model? And you've been writing a lot. So what have you been writing about lately?
A bunch of stuff. I'm trying now to, because when I started Substack right at the beginning of the pandemic, so a lot of things that I normally would have done in terms of going on the road, like covering the presidential campaign, I didn't have the opportunity to do that. So I'm trying to do a little bit more of that. I went out to Loudoun County, Virginia on election night in Virginia, and I'm working on kind of a traditionally like reported story about that whole fiasco now. So it's interesting. One of the things about this new model is it's difficult to replicate the situation that I had at Rolling Stone, where they would just tell me, go work on something for 8 weeks and come back with a story. Like, I can't really do that now. So I got to kind of report in between. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
So down there in Loudoun County, what did you discover? According to the corporate media that I've read, it's a hotbed of racists that are attempting to terrorize the school board members in their own community. Were you scared?
You know, this is one of these culture war stories that by the time the national media got hold of it, it started out as a simple sort of misunderstanding and disagreement, and snowballed gradually into this completely irrational, unbridgeable, hostile situation. And what actually happened bore no reality whatsoever to what was reported nationally. This whole thing really started. Do we have a minute for me to summarize?
Absolutely. It's your time. Whatever you'd like to chat about, that's what we're here today for.
So what happened was, there was this a little elementary school in Loudoun County, which is the richest county in America by a fair margin. And a little elementary school, they have this thing called project-based learning, which is where it's one of these new educational fads where they're trying to get everybody in the school involved in these cross-curricular approaches to teaching. So they were planning, making a plan for Black History Month in 2019. And the fourth grade teachers sort of said, well, we're going to be teaching the Underground Railroad. And one of the phys ed teachers raised his hand and he said, I've got this great idea, because I went to a training years ago where they did this Underground Railroad simulation in gym class, and we could do that as a supplement to your teaching in fourth grade. And they do it, and this has been done all around the country, not very successfully. There's been many controversies all over the country, but they did the program, and there was a Black student in the class who went home, told his parents or his or her parents that he had been made to play a slave game, and the parents,
oh boy, oh no.
Well, I mean, we can understand the reaction of the parent in that situation. Like,
sure, and your 9-year-old, you can understand how the 9-year-old interpreted what happened in school that day.
Absolutely, sure. Absolutely. It all makes perfect sense. But what ended up happening was rather than doing what you would think would happen, which would be, a meeting between the parents and the school, an apology, maybe, and if things went badly, like some sensitivity training, something like that. What this actually turned into was there had been a long simmering disagreement about much bigger issues at the school, specifically about admissions to the gifted program and about disciplinary procedures. So the local NAACP was upset that there were statistical inequities in the admissions process or in admissions to this gifted schools program. And they were about to file a long complaint against the schools. And they essentially, this incident was used to create a media furor that there was an outbreak of sort of racism in the school system that was then used to try to push changes in the gifted program admission system to decrease or de-emphasize test scores. So there's a whole lot of stuff there to chew on, but basically this comes down to kind of a weighty philosophical question over, like, how do you achieve, if you have an ethnic group that's lagging behind in admissions to a gifted program, like, how do you achieve that? Do you just numerically make it happen? Do you instill quotas? Do you do nothing? If you do quotas, then say the South Asian and Asian kids who are doing well, they're going to now not be in as much. But rather than present it as a serious issue that, you know, could have been thought out and discussed, it was presented to the media as this outbreak of, like, insane racism and people not wanting their kids to learn about slavery, which was totally not what happened. And so it turned into something way more divisive than it needed to be. And I'm sorry, I went on about this, but it's frustrating.
What's really fascinating about this is that, I mean, look, the right answer would be, what do we need to do so that all the kids can come up to speed academically to gain their math skills and their reading skills and so forth? And if they, you know, maybe were less advantaged, let's give them some extra attention right now so that they can get to that level. And right. I've seen very successful programs along with that. But the really fascinating part about this, and an area that I consider you to be one of the leading thought leaders, is about the way the media portrayed it.
Exactly.
And like, you were there on the ground as a trained reporter with decades of experience. And the way I'm understanding the story is nothing like the, we need to have Merrick Garland threaten terrorism prosecutions because these parents are doing something so horrible.
Yeah. It really bears no resemblance to that story at all. I think what happens is, you know, reporters, if especially national reporters, if you can't go there, you're really reliant on what somebody else has written. And, mm-hmm. you know, if the initial report, you know, in the Washington Post or the New York Times or whatever says something along the lines of parents were resistant to the teaching about our country's history, you know, that's framing it one way. Another way to put it, you know, what actually happened was the school was trying to teach the Underground Railroad story, did it kind of a ham-handed way. And this led into a hornet's nest of other issues that are really super complicated and hard to sort out. But that's not an easy headline. And what's infuriating is the willingness of national media to just go grab the third rail and take a story that didn't need to be divisive and polarizing, and they made it as polarizing as they could possibly make it.
Well, you talked about that in your book, Hate Incorporated, and you talked about that very phenomena on my show when you were with us before, about that the media outlets pick their audience, they want to cheer for their team, and they're really disregarding reporting and the facts that are on the ground. And instead saying, I'm going to seize this and we're going to call this racism, and those rubes down in Virginia don't want to teach a full American history. That's what they reported.
Right. Yeah. And they do that. I call it the audience optimization model. You know, it's like essentially they're picking who the audience is, and then they're crafting a narrative that they know is going to succeed with that audience. And that allows you to do, as an entertainment model, it works. As a business model, it works. It's terrible as a press model, because essentially what you're doing is you're pre-writing your takes on almost everything. You go into almost any situation and, you know, as a reporter, you can go to a place like Loudoun County and look for the quotes that you want that are going to support the thesis you've already written in your head, if you want to do it that way. Or, the way you should do it is you should go with an open mind and just do and tell people what you actually saw. But no, they're just playing to audiences now, and it's so much more transparent than it used to be. Even it was so much more transparent than when I wrote Hate Inc. Even, and that was only a few years ago.
Yeah, and what I this is my personal take on this, so bear with me as someone's not a professional in this. But you've got this new media model, and the new media model is pick your audience, feed them things that get them angry, outraged, get them to demean the other side, get them to believe the other side is stupid, that they're taking horse dewormer, or they're undermining the republic with their communist ties, you know, depending on what narrative you want. At the same time, maybe I'm a perpetual optimist, people are starting to go, you know what, we know that when we look at these corporate news groups, we know we're being lied to. Mm-hmm. And it seems that there are people that are saying, you know what, I'm going to pick my own brand of lies versus, you know what, give me something that's not lying. And maybe just to kind of get to the point of this, that's maybe where a Substack's being so successful today. You guys are actually reporting out there.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's when the audiences know in advance what you're going to say, they find that boring. Even if they're being openly manipulated, even if what they're being told coincides with what their belief system might tell them that they would like, eventually they start to tune that outlet out because they know they know that it's just to come on. It's basically a commercial. And if you're turning on, Fox or MSNBC and 100% of the time you can guess, what their read on a situation is going to be, that tells you an awful lot about the thinking or the level of thinking or lack thereof at that news outlet. I think Substack, you know, has been successful in large part just because it's unpredictable. Like, you don't always know 100% of the time what people are going to say. There's a lot of different voices. Some of them are more predictable than others, but at least there's a little bit of variability, which to audiences suggests, even on a superficial level, it just tells them that there's some thought that's going into what they're reading.
Yeah. So, you know, look, so you're doing reporting and you are unpredictable, which I think is what reporting's supposed to be, as well as many of your other writers, but you've drawn some heat for that. People are like, hey, what happened to Matt Taibbi? Like, who's he reporting for? Is he a liberal? Is he a conservative? Is he something else? We don't know what to do with this guy. Am I getting that right, first of all? Yeah. And isn't that a little weird?
No, it's totally predictable. Look, it's a disciplinary mechanism, these what happened to X stories. The king of these, obviously, is Glenn Greenwald. He's had about 15 of them written about him. You know, the whole idea is to send a message to everybody else in the business that once you, anybody who voluntarily leaves the Eden of sort of mainstream media recognition, not only are you going to no longer be plugged into all the easy avenues of money making, like speaking fees, you know, book deals, you know, there's lots of ancillary income streams that they kind of threaten you with if you deviate from the norm, but also there's going to be like a public shaming thing that goes on. You know, like in Greenwald's case, it was so egregious. Like, the New York Times did a story called "The Bane of Their Resistance." I'm sorry, it was a New Yorker, and Greenwald. The essence of that story was that he had dissented on the Russiagate story because, and they interviewed all these former coworkers and friends of Glenn's, who basically said things like, you know, he has daddy issues. He grew up confused because he's gay. One of his former editors said that he has trouble with the direction that the Democratic Party's going in with increased involvement with women and minorities. So they're saying, like, because you disagree with us intellectually about this thing, there's something pathologically wrong with you. You're, you know, a racist, whatever. Like, and, you know, people see that and they say, I don't want to deal with that. Like, and right, they won't step out of line. So I did get a story written about me in New York, but the reporter, this guy Ross Barkan, is a very good reporter, and he actually did, I think, a very fair job with me. But people still see that, and what they'll see is like, this is what's going to happen to me if I kind of step out of line a little bit.
Yeah, and the thing that's astonishing with that is that people don't think that because they go to a place like CNN, okay, and these rocket scientists over there couldn't find a scandal in their own building where one of their anchors was tipping off his brother. And of course, they're trying to cover the deaths in the nursing homes with the, you know, sex scandals, and doing a pretty fair job of it because people have kind of forgotten. I'm a healthcare guy, so I follow that a little bit more closely about pandemic response and data and that type of thing. But it's like, do people not even see this? It's like, here's CNN supposedly reporting the news. Here's a story in your building. And then you go, well, wait a minute. They're the same guys whose legal analyst masturbated on a Zoom call and he's back on the air.
Yeah, that was quick. Yeah. It's amazing. And it's also strange. It's kind of a new phenomenon too, because not that long ago, we really celebrated it in the news media when somebody was an independent thinker who kind of went against the grain. Like, that kind of personality was really encouraged. Mm-hmm. You think about somebody like Cy Hirsch, right? The notion of being the courageous one who goes against everybody else's instincts and sticks with a story no matter what. That's also the legend of Watergate, frankly, right? Like, the Washington Post was the only paper that really, really stuck with that. Nobody else believed it, right? Even early in my career, you know, I've always gone after both sides. This is not a new thing for me, like criticizing the Democrats. Like, I was pretty complimentary about Barack Obama when he ran for president. But then a year later, when I had to cover his response to the financial crisis, I wrote really long and pretty blistering pieces about him. And they were praised by people in the business because back then it was considered a sign of intellectual independence to do that. Now, you know, there's this monoculture that doesn't tolerate that sort of thing. They don't want you to think independently. They want you to think as a group. And that's different. And it's totally unsustainable as a way to do media, or to do the news anyway.
Well, it's unsustainable in a free society.
Right.
And I know you've had experience living in the Soviet Union and then in Russia. And you've written about that as well, which I find fascinating as you do those side by sides. But when I think about this groupthink or rightthink, is a time now when we have this bias that's put out by those that are elected or those that are in government bureaucracies. It gets picked up without question, relayed, amplified. And then what should be the liberating technologies to let us all communicate, they've now gone overboard with censorship.
Yeah.
And I really fear what's going on at Twitter right now. I mean, that was like kind of one place. And now, well, you can't put a photo up unless somebody's approved it.
Right.
And their definitions are so broad, you can kind of see what's going to happen here.
Yeah, I just wrote about this too. You know, the story of the internet going from being a place that had promise as sort of the ultimate democratizing and leveling tool to being an instrument of social control, I think is, you know, it's one of the biggest stories of our time. I would argue that it's probably the biggest story of our time because
I agree.
You know, it's a political story. You know, at the core level, this is about deciding who gets to see what, who gets to talk about what, who has the power to shape the issues that we debate. And the great thing about the internet previously was that it was a tremendous check on the kind of gatekeeping mechanism of corporate media, because there was no way to suppress a story. There was no way to prevent something that was true and interesting from getting out. You think about, you know, that when Dan Rather screwed up that story about George Bush, it was a tiny blogger who broke that story initially. That would never have happened previously. You would never have seen, you know, somebody who didn't have a voice on one of the big networks, you know, exploding a figure of that magnitude of that level of prominence. Now, I think that the powers that be have figured out that this is untenable for them. They can't afford to have this kind of a free dialogue, a challenge to the system, and they're turning these platforms into the same kind of gatekeeping mechanism that I saw in campaign reporters for years, you know, sort of getting together and deciding what is and is not acceptable coverage for people. I think it's terrifying.
Well, I think it's beyond terrifying. And I think we are very close to eliminating any kind of a thoughtful process, be it in a courtroom or be it in follow-up reporting. Think about the division over Kenosha, Wisconsin. The headline was, white officer shoots unarmed black man in the back. 7 times. That was the story. There was no, and again, I'm not going to comment on the officer's conduct. I guess I would point out that was investigated from the Civil Rights Department, and he was investigated by both state authorities, and it was said, no, he acted. It was, what was the man that was shot? Why were the police there in the first place? He was violating a personal protection order. He had assaulted the woman who made the call. He had stolen her car. He had her kids in the car. He fought the police. He was impervious to the taser. And he's now reaching under the seat for something, turned out to be a knife. And there's the officer. Everything else has been tried. I mean, I wish they had something else they could use, but he faced with that instant, do I let this guy drive off in a high-speed chase with 3 kids in the car, or do we stop it now?
Right.
All led up to that. And then, of course, with the city already in flames, we have, you know, more tragedy on tragedy. And then the resulting court case was decided in the media on basically non-facts. What do you call non-facts? I guess they're lies, right?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
That's my concern, Matt, is that so many people under so many stories have convicted someone on the first accusation before any further facts can be investigated and before any court. That's what I think is dangerous.
Look, there are lots of different ways to look at the Jacob Blake situation. You're right. The two government authorities investigated that, found they had insufficient, found that they probably wouldn't be successful in a prosecution for a variety of reasons. If you ask people in other countries who have different policing methods what their take on this would be, they would probably say America has too many shooting deaths involving police. But that's not because of what this individual officer did. It's because we just have a different way of doing policing in this country. But traditionally, the role of the media is we try to get things as right as we can in the first moments, and then we use the time afterwards to get ourselves closer to the truth. What happens now is we settle in on a narrative immediately, and then it's like the Alamo after that. They're just defending the narrative.
Yes.
going forward. And so a situation like what happened in Kenosha, yes, that you had a caricature in the first blush, but rather than go away from the caricature and tell the people about all the facts on both sides that might make you think a little bit differently about things, like, you know, in the Kyle Rittenhouse case, I don't love it as a parent. I wouldn't want my 17-year-old picking up a rifle and going into a situation like that. But that's different from the issue of, is he going to have a robust defense legally in this state, given that situation, given all this the evidence that came out. You know, it's not our job to characterize people and then get you worked up about it. It's our job to, like, kind of dispassionately, almost not caring, tell you what happened and then give you more information as it becomes available. And that's not what we're doing. We're building narratives and then just feeding them day after day after day.
Exactly. And one of the things, we had a fellow on, an author and educator, a couple episodes ago, a fellow by the name of Eric Bean, who wrote a book called Bias Is All Around You. Mm-hmm. And he went through step by step about how to, it's like a 100-page book, and then he's got worksheets, how you can spot bias, at who's doing it, where is it coming from, what are the techniques. And we didn't get too deep in any of the techniques, but again, I'd recommend the book. But one of the things, as a pattern recognizer, programmer guy, usually once a public accusation is made, that's kind of the pinnacle, and that's mm-hmm. where the story dies. And then when, you know, more facts come out, it's just, we just move on to the next thing. And we've got some interesting things in the news right now. I mean, Jussie Smollett trial started. Ghislaine Maxwell's in court. We have the Waukesha situation. We have the border and the, the Waukesha is pretty horrible. And you know, here in Oxford, Michigan, which actually the reporting has not been bad about that one. And it'll be interesting to see as that develops. A horrible tragedy. And then about the lockdowns that are going around the world, the protests, and then what we're doing with our border. It's a long list of things in the news. I don't know if you're, any of those have piqued your interest and what you're thinking about following up on.
I watch all that stuff just from a media aspect. I was kind of interested in the lack of interest in the Waukesha story. Like, it seems like it happened, and then all of a sudden the national media just decided it wasn't something they were going to focus on, and they moved on to something else. And I think there are a lot of questions about that. Like, what was the motive there? Do we know? Why is there a lack of curiosity about that? And that, I think that's a pattern that I've noticed with this new version of the news media that's different from what we used to have. Like, for instance, a big red flag for me initially with the Russia story, the Russiagate story, was the disinterest among my colleagues in the origin story of all this. Mm-hmm. Like, how did the investigation start? What was the thing that prompted it? We were already sort of well into Acts 2, 3, and 4 of this drama, and almost nobody was really interested in, well, where did this begin? When did the authorities start digging into this thing? And that's, again, that's totally new. Like, the old school reporters wouldn't have cared so much about what the impact of the story was. They would really be, it would just bother them on like almost a physiological level, like that I'm just missing elements of the story. I don't know what this is, and that upsets me. But they don't. We just don't think like that anymore in the press now, which is odd. I don't really know how to explain it.
Well, that's something that troubled me deeply too. That if you said, you know, well, this story doesn't really hold together. You know, that there's a guy in his 70s, been in his public eye pretty much his entire adult life, decided he wanted to be president, and said, you know what, Russians are the way to go.
Right.
Okay. That, all right. So, and I'm like, okay, that could be true. Let's investigate it. And it turned out it the whole story was garbage. And I didn't think Trump was a good president. I just kind of had this envision of him in the Oval Office, just like running from pillar to post and bouncing off things and slugging Diet Cokes down. But and that's easy for me to say, look, I don't think Trump was a great choice for president. I don't think he was a great person to be a president, and also say that the Russian reporting was garbage. And, you know, now the guy that was at the center of this, a guy named Mark Elias, has got 50 lawyers that he's running lawsuits about voting rights. And I've read some of the legislation. I've had a professor from University of Iowa, Derek Mueller, on talking about what's in the voting laws. Nobody's asking the question, where did Elias get the money to hire 50 lawyers and file hundreds of lawsuits?
Right.
I mean, it's like
who's the client?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, they proudly publishes just his rate just went up to $1,190 an hour.
Right.
Okay. And you can watch the guy hustling. I follow him on social media. He's getting people to register. I mean, by the way, he is like using Trump techniques to make money for Mark Elias.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We're talking about the guy who was the general counsel of the Hillary Clinton campaign in 2016. And where's the curiosity about stuff like that? With that same figure, you know, he was obviously the person who commissioned the Steele dossier.
Yeah.
And he was the person who paid for it. And for an entire year after that thing came out, the question of who financed it somehow eluded the entire National Press Corps. And we would never have found out were it not for a very strange and, by the way, temporary quirk in the House rules that allowed the Republicans on the Intelligence Committee to subpoena those records. If they had been in the minority, we would still not know that the Clinton campaign paid for the Steele dossier. And which again is an amazing thing. Think about how many news stories were generated by that, and how uncurious you have to be to not ask who paid for this thing. After it's especially if you're the one who's writing these stories, like it's just a safety procedure. You know, I mean, as a reporter, you're always terrified that something that you write is going to back up on you and turn into a lawsuit. And the idea that you would publish something and not know who was behind it or who was paying for it, I just can't. It's like unsafe sex on the ultimate level.
So look, I think that would make me nervous as a reporter. Is this right? But I think worse is when you know what you're writing is wrong. So Newsweek tried to cover for Rachel Maddow that they had two attorneys, Barbara McQuaid, who's a MSNBC legal analyst, and another woman. They wrote this story in Newsweek, and I read it, and I actually wrote a response to it. I put on my website, richardhelpy.com, called the Russian investigation takes the Smollett approach. Because in their cover story, they said, well, Steele was hired by, Republicans and then later by Democrats. It's like, no. The Washington Free Beacon hired Fusion GPS. They were out of the picture in early primaries after it was apparent Trump was going to get the nomination. You know, and I know you know this story. And then the DNC, through Perkins Coie, their legal counsel, hired Fusion GPS, then hired Steele. And I know they knew that was a lie when they wrote it. And I kind of took their article down piece by piece. And including that they made statements like all these people that didn't prove that Trump colluded must be lying, but like Mueller let them go.
Right.
Like, right. Like he got George Papadopoulos, but the other ones he said, no, I'm good here.
It's amazing. The idea that you would publish something knowing that it's wrong is, again, for people of my generation and older, we all remember the days of when you ran your story, you didn't sleep that night because you were terrified that somebody was going to look at it the next morning and find the thing that you screwed up, right? That might mean your career, you know? So I think most news reporters who, you know, cut their teeth before this last decade or so, we remember that thing. But you know, with this really began with the Russia story. Remember when BuzzFeed printed the Steele dossier? They had this disclaimer on the top that says, not only can we not verify this stuff, but we can actually tell you that there are errors in it that we've already found. But we're going to put this out there anyway because we're going to let the public decide. We're going to let the public decide. Now that's one level of that's not even dishonesty. That's a position that they're taking. But the next level is what most of the reporters did, which is they knew that they were running dicey material, or they knew they were only getting one side of the story from their mostly anonymous sources, and they ran it anyway because they were kind of in on it. You know, it's there's like a wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Sort of a relationship. And the thing I can compare this to is like there's a thing that happens on Wall Street where like a short seller will want to knock down a company. And what they'll do is they'll commission an investment bank to do a report about that company, and it'll be very, very negative. And they'll show the report to a reporter. Then they'll also take the report to the SEC or to the FBI. Now the reporter knows that he or she does not have a story unless the FBI or the SEC takes hold of the report. The instant they do, they can write a headline, this company is being investigated. but they're not evaluating the company on the merits. They're just looking at whether or not they have a technically a way to do the story. And that's a lot of what happened with the Russiagate story. Like a lot of these people knew that the information was totally dubious, but they were just waiting for a technical out that allowed them to put it out there. You know, what you describe with Newsweek is even a level beyond that, because that's just factually flat out wrong.
That happened this year. Yeah. I mean, this is not ancient history. Like this is all out now, and they wrote the cover.
Right. I mean, that started because the AP got it wrong initially, and AP corrected it within a couple of hours. But that legend continues to survive because of stuff like that, you know, and it's incredibly frustrating. You know, it's just more the attitude. Like it used to be a point of pride to not let that happen to you. And now, you know.
Yeah, well, so you know, it's as I'm listening to you explain this inside of reporting and the fear of getting it wrong, it just seems to me that the fear is, hey, the people on my side of the ledger aren't going to like this. I got to shape this and shade this and look the other way. I mean, the whole thing, the media should have had a comeuppance and sort of said, you know what, we really failed here. So far, one person from the corporate media, Terry Moran, said we're going to really have some people to answer to. There's been no accountability.
A few others, you know, Barry Meyer wrote a book for the, you know, about Fusion GPS that I think probably rubbed some people at his paper, the New York Times, the wrong way. But no, you're absolutely right. That idea, oh, I'm so afraid the people in my set aren't going to like me anymore. Think about the change in mentality. Reporters used to pride themselves on how tough they were, right? Like we were the guys who would go charging out and stand in front of a burning tank. And, you know, we would fight through the crowds and we weren't afraid of anything. And we were especially not afraid to piss people off. Like that was supposed to be part of the job requirement, is that you had to have that kind of personality.
Absolutely.
Now we're actively recruiting people who have the opposite instinct, who, you know, it's like that thing where, you know, when 50% of the deer decide to run one way, they all go. those are the kind of people that we're looking for in media now, which is just, it's just unusual to see it. It's a big change.
It is. And I think that it translates over to what we've seen in social media, you know, Facebook. And I followed that story. And again, I've written and talked about the power of tech monopolies and how they can non-person someone. And not one person in the media called out when Facebook is testifying. They're saying, hey, we don't make the rules. It was kind of like, regulate me before I harm again.
Right.
And all they really want is a franchise to keep their business going. And they'll censor anybody as long as they get to keep doing that. And that's what I think is happening with Twitter, with the change in leadership.
Yeah, no, definitely. And as regards to change in leadership, you know, I can tell you Jack Dorsey he's got a lot of critics, but he did call a lot of journalists, including me, for basically just sort of advice on, not even advice, as a sounding board. Like, what would be the speech implications if we did this, this, and this?
Oh, nice.
Which, you know, was very, very unusual, right? Normally, companies do not care what anybody thinks. I think this person actually has a conscience and agonized over some of these things. And now he's gone, and you saw what happened right away. They made made a sweeping decision that is going to turn basically Twitter into something that's, you know, algorithmic censorship, you know, on steroids. And if you talk to people in Silicon Valley, they'll tell you that most people don't have a sense of the scale of how big these platforms are. I mean, it's just not logistically possible to fairly do any kind of content moderation once you start talking about you know, factuality, or it's going to be weighed in one direction or another. It has to be done by machine, and machines can't do this stuff.
If people would diligence, so by way of example, I saw stories and saw video of the, you know, lockdown protests in France and elsewhere in Europe. And then Australia's got these quarantine camps. And I'm like, okay, that's, I don't think I believe that. So I go and I use my search engine and I try to find that. Can't find anything on it. So I use my VPN to go access an Australian ISP. And then I do a search. And now I'm starting picking it up. And whoa, they do have quarantine camps. And they are holding Aborigines. And they're holding people that arrive in the country, Australians and non-Australians. They've also restricted travel amongst their states over there. And I can't understand why this isn't a news story. That, is it a good public policy? First of all, it's a stupid public health policy. But it should be reported. And if you're proud of what you're doing, you should say, yeah, this is what we're doing because we think it makes sense.
Yeah. And that phenomenon of not being able to find the material, even though you're specifically searching for it, that's a freaky new thing that nobody seems to be complaining about enough. Like, for instance, I forget who it was recently. It might have been the Lauren Boebert thing. She gives this speech, and it's offensive and everybody's upset about it. And I wanted to see the original video. Oh, no, it wasn't that. It was Paul Gosar's video about AOC, right? Mm-hmm. Remember and there was a whole brouhaha about how it was threatening and all that. And I just wanted to see what the video looked like. I didn't have any feelings about it one way or the other, but the first like three or four pages of results when you went to search for it was stories contextualizing it for you. Yes. Can't find the root material because they want you to see what the prevailing opinion is long before you get to actually what the thing is. That's really upsetting because people need to be able to have at least access to the root material.
I've heard the people that are the talking heads on the and the reporters used to be the print media saying, hey, you know, Matt Taibbi's got more followers on Substack than watch our program at night. And it reminds me of the 1980 American car companies. They're like, hey, the Japanese are stealing our customers.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
No, like, you quit delivering a product people wanted to buy.
Yeah, and don't make cake cars.
Yeah. So talk to us as we wrap up here about where you think we are on a new media model. Can we focus on issues of ordinary people versus those inside the Beltway? Like, where are we with that? And just for the benefit of our readers, what can the average person do to be a better media consumer?
Well, I think we're in an interesting place. You find that there's, whether it's Joe Rogan, who has many times more viewers than either Rachel Maddow or Tucker Carlson, or it's Substack, which is doing extremely well. It's making money, which is unusual. The problem that I see, though, is that even though there's these big audiences are sustaining these independent media areas, there isn't yet an institutional mechanism for like hardcore investigative reporting. We haven't figured out a way to pay for that yet. We've been able to pay for podcasts. We've been able to pay for op-ed writing, but that thing still isn't there. And as for advice, I would just say, you know, news is an individualized experience. Try to find the core material. You should be able to find the source material. That's one of the great benefits of the internet, is that you can find the congressional report. You can mm-hmm. find whatever the source document is. In as many cases as you can, start with that. And also make an effort to read both the media you like and the media you dislike, because the algorithm is designed to keep you in a pen sort of surrounded by your own desires. It doesn't want you to go outside of that. And that's, you have to fight against that.
We've been talking today with reporter, author, columnist, Matt Taibbi. Highly recommend his books, his column. Please follow him on Substack. Matt, you've been super generous with your time today. We really appreciate it. Hope that we get to have this conversation again.
Thanks so much, Richard. Take care.
Thanks for joining us on The Common Bridge. Subscribe to The Common Bridge on Substack.com. Or use their Substack app, where you can find more interviews, columns, videos, and nonpartisan discussions of the day. Just search for The Common Bridge. You can also find The Common Bridge on Mission Control Radio on your Radio Garden app.